Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
I could dance with you till the cows come home. On second thought, I'd rather dance with the cows till you come home.
We all make hasty decisions. Second guessing helps us avoid the consequences of them.
Darling, you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go?
If you second guess yourself and your first guess turns out right, won't you just feel like a fool?
If you don't second guess yourself and your first guess turns out to be wrong, won't you feel like a fool?
I just want you to check out Mrs. Barlow's chart. I'm always second guessing myself when it comes to interstitial lung disease.
Oh, then you should definitely handle this yourself there, Brittany.
Should I stay or should I go?
What good is a Monday morning quarterback?
A little presumptuous of a first officer to second guess his captain's judgment.
Our guest is Sherry Rouse, author of Tracking Truth, Knowledge, Evidence, and Science.
Second guessing ourselves.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Should I stay or should I go?
Thank you for listening to this week's free stream.
Philosophy Talk is made possible through donations from listeners like you, and we need your support now more than ever.
Please head over to philosophytalk.org/benefits to learn more. You can become a member of the community of thinkers at various different levels.
Help us stay on the air and online
while getting the most out of Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And most of all, thank you for donating.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus across the bay. That's where Ken and I occasionally teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, it's second-guessing ourselves.
Well, Ken, you want to know my view about second-guessing? Don't do it. It's like Sir Alistair says in the Game of Thrones. Leadership is all about getting second-guessed by every clever little twat that has a mouth. But a leader starts second-guessing himself, that's it. That's the end.
John, but even leaders sometimes make rash judgments and uninformed choices. I know you've got to agree that we would all have been better off had Bush and company done a little second-guessing of themselves when it came time to their disastrous decision to invade Iraq, for example.
Well, who's to say they would have gotten it better the second time around? They probably would have invaded Australia. Besides, you start down that path and you'll soon be second-guessing your second guesses, and that, you know, it could go on forever.
Well, but I'm not suggesting that you should never stick to your beliefs and decisions. But that doesn't mean you should always stick to them either. It's not an all-or-nothing thing, John.
Have you got some nice, neat mathematical formula for deciding when it's a good idea to second-guess yourself? Personally, I doubt that there could be such a thing.
I think you should reconsider those doubts, John.
Ha!
Let me give you an example. Suppose you catch a glimpse of some person in the distance. You think it might be me. Suppose you're pretty sure, but you're not 100% certain. Maybe, just to give it a number, you're 70% certain.
Well, I don't want to burst your bubble, Ken, but you're a fairly distinctive-looking fellow. I mean, you're pretty hard to mistake.
Okay, play along with me, though, just for a second. Okay, later on, I tell you that it wasn't me that you saw. Now, are you going to just stick to your original belief? Isn't it reasonable? Isn't it fully rational now for you to reduce your confidence, maybe all the way down to zero, that it was me you saw? It wasn't me. Now, you should
know. I know. I probably just figure you were lying. I mean, probably I saw you at some very intimate dinner, staring longingly at some cute girl who wasn't your wife, and you
don't go there. Don't go there. Look, my point is that sometimes our confidence can be less than complete. When we get more evidence, we should be willing to change our degree of belief, up or down, in light of that new evidence. Look, if I told you that it really was me that you saw, wouldn't your confidence shoot up, and wouldn't it be rational for it to shoot up all the way from 70 up to 100%? Come on.
Well, Ken, I don't really think you're talking about second-guessing oneself. You're talking about just reconsidering old beliefs in the light of new evidence, pro or con. Now, rational people do that. I even do it sometimes. But what rational people don't do is what I would call second guessing, which is you make a decision based on evidence, and then all of a sudden, based on no evidence whatsoever, you reconsider. Once the evidence is in, you've made up your mind, stick to your guns, full speed ahead. Don't go changing your mind just because you think you might possibly be wrong.
But look, John, what if that belief that you might possibly be wrong is itself based on evidence? Not on evidence about whether I was in that restaurant or not, but on evidence about your own degree of reliability. What about that?
I don't get you.
Well, suppose that you found out, I don't know, that your glasses had been toyed with and that now they had a tendency to distort your vision. What about that?
I guess a pretty far-fetched scenario. So I take my glasses off. Oh, it's Justin Bieber.
But it makes my point. If you found out that your vision was being distorted, wouldn't it make sense to change your degree of confidence in your belief that it was me that you saw? Even though you got no new direct evidence as to whether I was there or not, you got evidence about yourself.
Well, but look, I mean, everyone all the time is subject to some sort of distorting influence when they draw a conclusion or make a decision. You can't get away from it. If you let your confidence be undermined by this possibility, it leads to self-doubt, skepticism, and inaction. You won't be an effective human being
John,
like me.
John, I think you're just painting a stubborn refusal to reconsider as some sort of epistemic virtue or something.
And you're painting a spineless indecisiveness as an epistemic virtue.
Well, look, it's obvious. I'm not going to get you to reconsider without a little help. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Natalie Jones, to find out what happens when we second-guess ourselves in situations where real results are on the line. She files this report.
This is a test.
Take out your number two pencils.
This is only a test.
Have you ever taken a test and put down an answer, then gone back and second-guessed yourself? You almost change it, but then you think, maybe I should stick with my gut. That's always right. Right?
It seemed like go with your first instinct was out there and widely believed by people, yet we wondered whether this was actually as good a strategy as you would believe given how widely accepted it was.
In 2005, Derek Wirtz was a psychology grad student at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. He and his colleague, Justin Kruger, decided to look into this urban legend. The researchers asked students if they believed the gut instinct strategy, and a majority did. Then they combed through decades of research and found the results just didn't match up.
Overwhelmingly, research on answer changing suggested the opposite of go with your first instinct. It suggested that when people change answers, they usually benefit from doing so. That is, most answer changes are from wrong to right, rather than from right to wrong, which is what you would expect if go with your first instinct was an ideal strategy.
All right, well, let's get into it. Let's jump to page 67.
At a recent test prep class in San Francisco, many students still believe the maxim. And student Kyle Sung automatically associates uncertainty with a wrong answer.
I mean, when I'm pretty confident, then I'm pretty sure I got the question right. But if I'm unsure, I most likely got it wrong.
Wirtz, now a professor at East Carolina University in North Carolina, found people are more scared of changing from right to wrong than being wrong to begin with.
You think one answer is right, but then you start to think of changing your answer. And you do change your answer, only to find out that your first instinct was right all along. And how frustrating would that feel? You had the right answer and you foolishly changed it.
But finding out later that we could have changed from a wrong answer to a right one is also frustrating. Why don't we remember those times as well? Wirtz has a theory.
It's a mistake that you made because of an inaction instead of a mistake that you made because of an action. And it's easier for us to mentally undo actions than to sort of mentally undo inactions.
So how can we have the best of both worlds? Get the right answer without driving ourselves crazy with second guessing. I asked Colin Gruenwald, who is the director of ACT and SAT programs at the test prep company Kaplan.
Good reasons why you would change your answers would include if you finished early and you had the opportunity to go back and say, oh, wait a minute, I was thinking about this, but I should have been thinking about that. That's great. That would be where you realized something you didn't know before.
Gruenwald and his colleagues tell students they're required to go back through and check their answers if they have extra time. but they should avoid changing answers for bad reasons.
One of the most common I know of is just the fear of seeing a pattern in your answer choices. Students are very conditioned to think, if there's a pattern, I must have done something wrong.
Patterns do randomly happen, he says, and mean nothing. Gruenwald also tells students to avoid thinking that they're being tricked or trapped. That's an emotional response, rather than one based on the question itself. Still, in test-taking, second-guessing is often a luxury.
The vast majority of students will never change an answer because they won't have the opportunity to or they won't have the desire to.
But for the ones who do and can question themselves without letting doubt spiral out of control, research shows they might be rewarded with a few more right answers. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.
Thanks, Natalie. I'm now ready for the next test I have to take, except I'm retired and I'll never have to take another test. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow Stanford philosopher, I think it's Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley. She's author of Tracking Truth, Knowledge, Evidence, and Science. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Sherry Rausch.
Sherry, you're interested in the way our beliefs do or do not track the truth. Now, why did you get interested in that problem? Was it problems you have with tracking the truth? You always second-guessing yourself? Or was it other people whose epistemic screw-ups got you fascinating with this topic?
Well, a little both and neither. I've always thought I was very good at self-reflection and self-doubt and improved my knowledge in that way. I also noticed that it was undervalued, like you were just doing. And I noticed that just doing a lot of thinking about yourself doesn't necessarily end up with a good result. Mainly with boyfriends, I noticed that. When they tried it out, it kind of didn't work.
I see.
So I think I was primed to notice in my intellectual work cases where I couldn't see how to resolve the doubt because I was very good at that. And if even I couldn't see it, it must be a hard, interesting problem.
Early.
Yeah.
Okay, so with that display of self-confidence. So the report we just heard suggests that second-guessing isn't such a bad idea. So how about giving us a kind of a definition of what second-guessing is and explain why it's not such a bad idea?
Well, there are two kinds of evidence. One is the evidence we base our beliefs on about the world. It's about the world. And then there's this other kind that's evidence about ourselves and our judgment, whether we're fit to judge these kinds of things. And looking at a little bit of the second can help you actually improve your beliefs about the world because you can correct for your contribution to a bad belief.
So you agree with me, right? That's what I was saying
well,
to Don.
But it's not always a good idea. And so that's why I think we need a theory, my theory, to give us some guidance about that.
Okay, so you want to have it both ways? So, because I said you consider some evidence about yourself, your glasses are distorting, you have bad memory, whatever, right? Oh, maybe I shouldn't trust that judgment that I made. John said, oh, you get the evidence, you weigh it, you keep going. So it sounds like, I'm not sure, you sound like, are we both right, both wrong? What is it?
Well, it's kind of both and neither. Sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's really not. And it depends on your evidence and whether you're using your evidence well. For example, a kind of thought that isn't good is, I might be wrong. I mean, if you might be wrong, all that means is it's a logical possibility. All you need to do to take care of that is to just not be rigidly certain about it, right? So you're done.
So that's like what John was saying. John said, oh, you've got no evidence. Like, why should you believe, second guess yourself, on the basis of no evidence, just the possibility you might be wrong? So you agree with him about that, but you agree with me about, well, look, if you get some evidence that you're cognizing is somehow distorted, then you should second guess yourself? Is that summing it up, right?
Yeah, yeah. And when you run out of evidence, you should stop.
Well, okay, so we're going to dig into this some more. This is a fascinating area. This is Philosophy Talk. coming to you from the Mars Theater. Our guest is Sherry Rausch from UC Berkeley, and we're asking about second-guessing ourselves.
In our next segment, we're going to talk about assessing one's own abilities to make good judgments and decisions. How can we get better at it? Can we know simply by looking inward, by introspection, that things are on shaky grounds? Is experience the best teacher when it comes to assessing ourselves? If so, what kind of experience?
Assessing our self-assessments, along with questions from our self-assessing audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Examining Ethics is a new podcast hosted by Andrew Cullison that tackles many of the ethical questions, large and small, we face in our everyday lives. You can subscribe for free on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast, or listen online at examiningethics.org.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and I will not second-guess that opinion. Our guest is Sherry Rausch from UC Berkeley, and we're thinking about second-guessing ourselves.
Are you likely to second-guess yourself? Or do you tend to trust your initial decisions? If so, do you think that's because you're especially entitled to trust yourself, or you're just kind of stubborn? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
So, Sherry, I'd like to think that just as people can get better at making first-order judgments about the world and what's going on in it, I mean, practice makes perfect, so maybe they can get better about making judgments about how good or bad they themselves are about making such judgments. But is there any reason to think that people can actually do that?
Well, I think there is, because basically there's only we can only go up. We're so bad at it. Just to achieve mediocrity would be an improvement. But the things that we do are, everybody to some extent responds to feedback from other people about how good you are at doing things. We also have memory of our own track record of performance. You get grades on your exams. If you remember them, you might better judge whether you should doubt. There are various ways of thinking. Heuristics that help. One is thinking concretely about ways that you might be wrong. If you are wrong, how might you be wrong? So you're doing an algebra word problem. How might you be wrong? Well, you might have mistranslated it from words to equations. Or you might have calculated wrong. Once you start focusing on specifics, things come to mind that you already know but you weren't paying attention to.
So we're all fairly practiced at diagnosing when other people are likely to have made mistakes or bad decisions. Is it the same skill when it's ourselves, are there different skills involved, or do we tend to be worse at doing it with ourselves than we are at others, or do these people who are good at one tend to be good at the other?
Well, ideally, I think the two processes should be the same. We should observe ourselves just as we observe others, golden rule kind of thing. But that's not what actually happens. We have a lot of heuristics and biases that, for example, confirmation bias, which is at play also here as in everything else.
Confirmation bias is?
We look for and only see evidence that favors the opinion we already have.
Oh, okay.
So if we start out confident, so in a sense, we're more likely to see problems with other people's opinions than our own. And it's advantageous.
But that suggests that maybe this problem is really hard to make go away. You could tell a story about ideally rational agents and how they ought to update their beliefs and change their minds and whether they should second guess. I'm not sure whether an ideally rational agent would ever have reason to second guess, but we're not ideally rational agents. You said, well, there's all kind of confirmation bias, and that's just the tip of the iceberg of the bad ways that humans reason. But you also said, well, I have to have evidence. It's not just the general skeptical doubts, the philosopher says, you might be a brain in the vat. That's not like enough, right, from your point of view. But you also have to have evidence. But here's what people do with evidence. Mm-hmm. They say, yeah, John's subject to confirmation bias, and Sherry's subject to confirmation bias, and that gentleman out there is subject to, but me, No. Uh-uh. I mean, here, so one question for you. Is the fact that humans in general are prone to make certain kind of cognitive errors, isn't that already evidence that I'm prone to make them too? And so in a particular case where they might be relevant, I should wonder?
Absolutely. And that's because you can, or a human being too. Philosophers tend to get this wrong. This applies to other people, but not to us, because we're so reflective. But absolutely, it's prima facie evidence. And you can be startled by these things, you know. You're very confident about, you're an eyewitness, you're very confident about who the murderer is because you saw it, right? And then you learn about this mountain of empirical evidence that human beings are overconfident when we're confident. And if that surprises you, then you probably haven't taken it into account.
So that makes me wonder, just following this line a little bit, how our late colleague and dear departed colleague had a thing in a book he wrote about knowledge about the nervous engineer who was always checking the dial. It's set to one, and he's always checking, is it still, is it still? And he kind of recommended you shouldn't be like the nervous engineer. But it sounds like if human beings are cognitively fallible enough, should we be like the nervous engineer, always wondering, did I do that right? Did I do that right? Or should we be like John, full steam ahead, you know?
Well, neither one of those answers is right because, you know, as the philosopher always says, it depends on the case. It depends on whether you have evidence or not. Once you've used up your evidence, you stop where you are.
I'm not quite sure what that means. I have evidence that human beings, of which I'm just one, are massively cognitively fallible. How do I use up that evidence? I mean, it's just there.
You need to, first of all, to use it at all, it has to be a little more specific, like eyewitnesses are overconfident. But now, suppose you're that person I talked about and you find out this general evidence. You reduce your confidence a little bit. That seems rational. But now you're done. It isn't that you can't use that evidence again.
Oh, I see.
Right? So these it's really a cognitive mistake to fall into a spiral. You always run out of evidence at some point.
Now, I find in my own case that one reason I'm a little... Well, the other day I couldn't find my passport. I had to fly to Vancouver the day before. Thinking I was being very careful, I went and looked in the file where we put our passports, and it wasn't there. And I remembered putting it there. So I went into a panic, and I must have checked that file 6 or 7 times, right? And the problem was that if I didn't put it in the file, it wasn't just that I misremembered. It was that I was a disorganized person who probably, you know, would never, ever do anything right and never had done anything right. And then my wife took a little more rationally. She says, well, why don't you just try to figure out the last time you used your passport and track from there? And I eventually found it upside down on a photocopy machine. but I do think that, you know, figuring out and admitting that I may have made a bad decision is much more threatening than, say, noticing that Ken has made a bad decision.
Right, right, right. It's easier because then it's his problem.
Yeah, yeah. And if it points to further character defects, that's his problem, not mine.
Well, there's another thing. You said something about feedback from other people. I don't mean to diss our humankind too much, but people get feedback from other people in terms of disagreement, right? Mm-hmm. And I know philosophers write about what they call peer disagreement, where there's a person I think is equally rational, equally good at weighing evidence and all that, equally possessing of evidence, and they disagree with me. And I think P, they think not P or something else. And you've written about this kind of stuff, right? And there's all this fancy philosophy. But here's the fact. That thing of regarding another person as an epistemic peer is mostly that if you disagree with me, there must be something wrong with you. So how do I get feedback from other people when I'm... It's like an instance of confirmation bias. You must be... You know, so isn't it hard for us to accept the feedback from other people?
Yeah, definitely. You know, for emotional reasons, for all these biases that are built into us, probably by evolution, there must be some kind of advantage where we look for evidence that supports what we already believe, but also our evidence is always incomplete, and we tend to disambiguate it in the way that's favorable to what we want to believe, that kind of thing, endless things like that. So it's actually rare, this situation that the philosophers study, where we actually regard someone else as equally reliable, and when they give a different answer, we still regard them as equally reliable, you know.
So this is complicated stuff. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about second-guessing ourselves with Sherry Rosh, and we're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater. We've got questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I live in Berkeley. And you talked about when your evidence is used up. Well, does it ever really happen? I mean, isn't the real question about how much time and effort and how much of your resources are you going to devote to finding more evidence on either side? I mean, that's kind of like what the scientific process is. I mean, there are a whole lot of scientific questions we're not completely certain about. We're never completely certain about them, but, you know, we don't have all the money in the world to do these great experiments that a whole lot of scientists have proposed. And you do talk a lot about science in your book.
Right. Well, we run out of evidence, actually, at some point in time. And then there's that decision, do we find more? And that cost resources. But at that given time, if we don't actually have any more, we have to stop with the confidence we have.
Wait a minute. So I've got, I'm George Bush. And I've got the energy department telling me, oh, those tubes, aluminum tubes, were they? You can't make centrifuges out of those. And I've got the Defense Department or something, the Pentagon saying, well, yes, you can. And I've got both these respected agencies. And there, one says, yay, and one says nay. What am I supposed to do?
Go to someone you trust, like Dick Cheney, and say.
So I'm trying to figure out how, because they turned out to be wrong. Now, if they were rational decision makers, they'd think, what would they think? Oh, that's the occasion on which I would have second-guessed myself. But the evidence was equivocal. So what, I mean, I'm not quite sure.
Well, that's precisely why they should have second-guessed themselves. So you come up with this opinion based on, you know, it's probably unconscious, your reasons for doing it might have been based on evidence. But then, if you think of the government as one big person, you find that there are these two voices in your government, two cabinets or whatever they call them, and they have different opinions based on arguments and stuff. That fact itself, which is a fact about us and our reasoning, is a reason to stop and think. We need more information to resolve that, or else we should suspend belief.
But it's not a rational thing to do ever to just plop down for one. I mean, so I got the Defense Department, I got the Energy Department. I'm not going to say I believe it's imminent, the threat, and I have to make a decision. I just plop down for the Defense Department. Is that an irrational thing?
It sounds a little bit to me like if I had a gun to my head, then I have to do something, and it's rational to do something, I suppose.
Well, I mean, they used to
but
say...
But we didn't have a gun to our head.
Andrew Jackson said in the War of 1812, or maybe it was Daniel Boone in the War of 1814, I don't know. But anyway, shoot when you see the whites of their eyes. Now, I could imagine sitting there thinking, well, I think that's the white of his eyes, but I mean, you know, maybe it's not the white of his eyes. Maybe it's the, you know, I mean, it could, I, you know, bang, I'm dead. Right, so there are occasions when it's
absolutely
really a bad idea to second guess
right
yourself.
Right, we sometimes need to do snap judgments, but also sometimes our snap judgments are very reliable. For example, in visual perception, we come equipped with lots of second order things. So, for example, if your visual field were to go uniform or blank, that's a cue my system isn't working anymore. We tend to automatically adjust our beliefs to that. But that's probably because, you know, vision is very important for getting around the world. A rock is not going to be persuaded by your confidence that it's not there, you know.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Steve. I live here in Berkeley. I'm thinking of all this, how all this connects to our political discourse in this country, which seems to be increasingly polarized. Each side, you know, talking to their own people who agree with them and presenting confirming evidence and confirming opinions. I'm wondering what we can do to break down those barriers, both in ourselves to open our own minds to valid, legitimate evidence and opinions from the other side, and also how to get those who disagree with us to pay more attention and to be more open-minded and willing to second-guess their own opinions and listen to ours.
You got any advice for our body politic?
Yeah, it's a really hard question. But I have an idea, which is that I think one of the reasons we resist the self-doubt and the openness to it is precisely we're afraid of that spiral. And if you understand that there's a way of doing it that doesn't lead to the spiral, then I think that enables us, because this is sort of a cognitive answer to you, that enables us to be more comfortable allowing other people to come in and...
So John's worry, I think, is a real worry, the worry he expressed. But if you start down this path, mm-hmm. it's just going to lead to skepticism and inaction, mm-hmm. right, indecision. And, I mean, philosophical arguments for skepticism are basically arguments to get you to second guess mm-hmm. any belief that you're tempted to hold, right? It says, wait a minute, well, you don't believe that. And it's really hard to defeat skepticism. But you suggest there's a way to be a rational second guesser, as it were, but contain the impact of the propensity. How you do that?
Well, we have to remember that we started with an opinion. Even the philosophical arguments that come in, the default is where we started. So it's the skeptical side that has to work. Its argument has the burden of giving us a doubt, and just giving us these generic doubts, like I said before, is not. It's not that impressive to me.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Jackie. I'm from Alameda. And I guess my question is about the difference between the right decision and the best decision. So, like, the examples you're using with the roving philosophical reporter was really about the right decision. There is a right decision. The answer is A or it's B. You know, it is the whites of their eyes or it's not. And I think then it's very easy to say when you should have second-guessed yourself and when you shouldn't have. However, when it's a best decision, like should I take this job or that job, should I go to this school or that school, should I marry this person or not marry this person, mm-hmm. it's much more complicated, right? Because there isn't necessarily a right decision, but we tend to think there is a right decision rather than just one decision that may or may not work out, and there's a million other things down the road that could happen. So it feels like that thinking that everything has a right decision actually makes making the best decision much more complicated and easier to second-guess yourself because you're looking for the right decision when maybe there isn't one.
That's an excellent question.
Yeah, that expecting that there's a unique answer can interfere with your ability to get the best of the options or even one of the better ones.
I think it makes a very good point because, you know, when you take these tests, then the counterfactuals are, if I'd answered that, I would have gotten it right. There's an answer. But, you know, when you go into this profession or that profession or invade this country rather than some other country you might have invaded or start, you know, World War I, there's so many counterfactuals. What if we hadn't done that? You know, would World War II have happened, so forth and so on? That the idea of thinking back and having feedback on the quality of one's decisions in these regular cases is often pretty impossible.
Yeah, and they tend to be very multidimensional and complicated. And that means also that if you try to find a track record, you're not going to have very many instances. How many times was I deciding before whether to go into this field or not?
Zaza Gabor maybe could make a pretty good judgment about how good she is at choosing husbands, but most...
Yeah, right, but yeah.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about second-guessing with Sherry Rush, author of Tracking Truth.
If you start down the path of second-guessing all of your beliefs and decisions, don't you inevitably end up being a spineless skeptic or a philosophy professor or somebody incapable of having firm convictions or taking decisive actions? Could there be a principle that tells us when it's rationally required to second-guess ourselves without leading us all the way into spineless skepticism and indecision?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California. We'll take more questions from our self-assessing, second-guessing audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Examining Ethics, a new podcast hosted by Andrew Collison, takes on ethical questions with stories and deep discussion. You can subscribe to it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, or listen online at examiningethics.org.
Unless you're thinking, better not move on to that second thought. Toss the flyer, walk away. Do not do it. Do not do, do not do the yoga.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones, for that good advice. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Sherry Raj from UC Berkeley, and we're asking about the nature and philosophy and rationality of second-guessing.
So, Sherry, at the top of the show, Ken made the case that sometimes the rational thing to do is to second-guess. I worried about whether starting that down that path leads to indecision. But is there a principled way based on some epistemological insights that a person like you has had that we could formulate to escape that fate?
Well, it starts with the fact that to be rational is only to use the evidence you have to ask, what should I believe given where I am? You know, that's the best you can do, right? And then the formula, the way the formula goes, roughly, as we've already talked about it, one instance would be you look back at your track record. You say, well, I'm 90% confident now. Look at all the times I was 90% confident before about this kind of thing. Well, suppose I was right 70% of the time. So I should move my confidence to 70%. And then, if there's no other evidence, I should stop. That's the rational thing to do.
So you kind of adjust your confidence by your track record or something.
You can do it that way, or yeah, there are other ways.
I mean,
well, like with our visual equipment, we do it automatically. It's like we know we do not do it consciously. But so it's not that kind of evidence. We also, you might have a friend tell you that you have trick glasses on. That's just a piece of testimony, you know. And if you trust your friend, well, you don't need a track record.
Right. Okay. But so you were towards the end of our last segment. You were saying, and especially with these complicated decisions, like how many times have I decided to invade a country, or how many times have I decided to get married, or choose a career? Not too many times. So it's not like I've got some extensive track record.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know this general stuff. People are bad at these things for this, that, and the other reasons. I'm one of these. So, I mean, does that really help? I mean, because how much evidence do you have about your track record?
Right. I like the marriage case because you can set it up as a puzzle. We have lots of statistics on marriage, and we all know about them.
Yeah.
It's whatever the precise number is, it's like 60% of first marriages end in divorce. So what exactly are you doing when you're taking your vows? Are you completely irrational? Well, I think sometimes we are, and we don't like to ask this question at weddings, you know. And you're right, unless you're like Larry King, you don't have much of a track record for yourself individually. But there are things that you might know about yourself or you might try to take into account, like maybe you think that you and your partner have good ways and methods for resolving conflict. And, you know, that's a reason. Of course, these things are all going to be, they're going to be a plunge at some point. But
so basically, you could go to every wedding, and when the minister says, is there anyone who has some reason why these people should not be joining wedlock, you could stand up and say, well, look at the track record that people have. Odds are, if they thought this through.
Yeah, have they considered that?
Yeah,
if you don't get an answer here, well, you know.
You might not be invited to too many weddings.
We got another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Thank you. I'm Colleen from Berkeley. And I came here today because my brother is always telling me that I'm wishy-washy when I'm trying to make restaurant decisions for the family. And I'm always trying to take into account who's eating what, are the kids going to be there, or this or that, whenever we get together. And he tends to think, just make one decision and stick with it, no matter how many people decide to come or who comes, and look tough. And I'm trying to, you know, I'm reminded that John Kerry, when he said, I was for it before I was against it. And then my thought on him was that he's just more faceted. He looks at things from different points of view, and he looked strong to me, and he looked weak to others.
Right.
So I'm wondering, am I the weak one, or is my brother the weak one? That's what I want to know.
Just a quick question. Is this an older brother?
Yeah.
You're the middle child?
No, I'm the second.
You're second.
We always fought. So
second children tend to be the compromisers and the people that take everyone's views into account, I know, as a second child.
Do you think Carrie was the second child?
I don't know.
There seem to be two competing epistemic virtues. There's a kind of decisiveness. Weigh the evidence, make a decision, make a choice, form a belief, stick with it, right? Act on it, really believe it. Mm-hmm. But there's something like, oh, well, consider everything and don't believe too, and not just consider everything out there, consider you your own. And that seems like some kind of virtue because it's more openness and all that sort of stuff. I mean, how do we weigh these? I mean, am I right that these are kind of competing epistemic virtues? They kind of pull us in opposite direction? And
yeah, I think you are, because sometimes, at least, we do have evidence at the first order, you know, about the way the world is or should be. And it's good to take that into account. And sometimes that evidence is better than the quality of the evidence we have about ourselves. So the best we can do is really go with our instinct. And it's hard to know the difference sometimes. The case we were just talking about, it's easy to know that you don't have a track record if you're doing a first marriage. So,
right. Well, you could have decided many times not to get married and been
That's
right.
True. Yeah. Right. But how did you know you were right?
How would you know though? But that thing that the guy from the Lord of the Game of Thrones said. I mean, you can see the power in that, especially a leader. You know, he has to make it's not so much forming beliefs, but taking action. Mm-hmm. Making decisive choices, you wouldn't want a leader who was really waffling like that. I mean, it seems, but of course you wouldn't want a leader who was just rash either.
Well, so it was fatal for Kerry when he said that. Was fatal for Mitt Romney's dad way back in the day when he said, well, I was brainwashed about Vietnam. We really don't like indecisive leaders, and then after we elect them, we don't like the decisive ones either.
So. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ben.
Thank you. My name is Linda. I'm from Berkeley as well. I'm interested in the correlation or relationship between the tendency to second guess and the seriousness of the consequence at hand. If it's a matter of what restaurant or what movie to see, it's one thing. But as an example, if I'm walking down the street and a dog runs out and bites me and runs away, and I don't know whether it's had a rabies shot or not, you know, I may run home and say, well, we find out what's the chance of it having rabies and what are the side effects if I go through the treatment. But the consequence of not going for the treatment could be dire. So I'm wondering if there's a relationship there.
It's a really good question, too. We're having great questions today. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this goes back to the question about whether you should gather more evidence or not. So I said you should stop second-guessing once you've exhausted your evidence. But there's a different with the evidence you actually have. But you're asking, you know, when is it, should I go for more evidence? And that definitely depends on the stakes, you know. You might want to go for more evidence if it's a high-stake thing, like war or fatal disease or...
Let me just ask you a little off-the-wall question while we're... there are these different overall epistemological stances, like Bayesianism, that you should always be figuring out the probabilities of stuff, and, you know, search for the best explanation, reason from first principles. Do you have a background epistemology that you think is especially good for thinking about the problem of second guessing?
I
know the answer.
You know the answer to this. I use the Bayesian framework, but there are specific reasons for that. It's not. I don't always use that. In this case, there's an issue of consistency. You know, how is it that if we second guess ourselves, we can be one person when it seems like now there are two people at war? So the Bayesian system, it has axioms, and it's basically got one value, which is consistency. So if you write things down, if you write down the questions in those terms, you're getting, it's much easier to see what consistency requires.
Mm-hmm. Take one last question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ben.
Thanks. I'm Christine from San Francisco, and earlier you mentioned eyewitness accounts, and I was wondering what you thought of their utility in the justice process based on the fact that I believe I read it's something like half of what we remember is true or something like that.
Yeah, I think that the evidence we have about ourselves is alarming given that trials depend so heavily sometimes on eyewitness testimony. And I think the courts are taking notice of this, and they're giving instructions to juries about this evidence about eyewitness testimony. In fact, that case was one of the reasons I got into this question, because I thought, suppose you're a juror, and you hear this testimony, and then you hear the judge's instructions about general things about eyewitness testimony, what exactly are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to adjust the individual, you know, the degree to which you believe that individual testimony to this just very general evidence? How do you do that?
Did you come up with an answer?
Well, actually, I have a fantasy about having a formula, you know, that is actually used. So like Leibniz said, let us calculate, sir, for justice, questions of justice.
You're a philosopher after my own heart.
Sherry, you haven't gotten it yet.
No. We need a lot more evidence to put fill in the blanks.
But Sherry, this has been a really fascinating conversation, and I refuse to second guess that judgment. I'm firmly convinced, but I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been so much fun.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Sherry Rausch, professor of philosophy from UC Berkeley, author of Tracking Truth, Knowledge, Evidence, and Science. So, John, you started out with a stubborn refusal to reconsider. Are you willing to second-guess yourself now?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, we've got to role-play to get these decisions out there. I'm in the midst of a lot of uncertainty because I'm reading two books on epistemology written by brilliant young faculty members, one at Stanford, Crystal Lawler, who's got kind of an Austinian take, and one by Sherry Rausch, who's got kind of a Nozickian take. And so...
You don't know what to believe.
I don't know. I mean, I think probably the best thing is to kind of stop halfway through both of them and go on to something else because, you know, too many good arguments on both sides. You know?
Well, you know, I think this is a really fascinating topic. I hadn't really thought really hard before we decided to do this show about the rationality of second-guessing yourself. But it's actually a fascinating topic. I didn't get to ask Sherry whether an ideally rational person who considers their evidence without any distortion would ever have a reason to second guess. I wonder what she would have said about that. But you know, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. You, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our webpage, philosophytalk.org.
Now, without a second thought, let's hear from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, like many of you, I suspect, I have a friend who knows much better how to live my life than I do. There are many such people in the world. If you tell them you bought a hammer at the hardware store, they tell you that hardware store has a better deal and a better hammer. If you break up with a girlfriend or boyfriend, this friend is the first to tell you he or she was never right for you. If you're doing it wrong, they will let you know. If you're doing it properly, they will tell you you should have done it sooner. Unfortunately, these friends are not psychic. They can't tell you what you should have done before you shouldn't have done it. Personal lives aside, an amazing amount of American culture seems to be devoted to second-guessing. Monday morning quarterbacking by armchair generals. Not only how a bad play in a football game could have been avoided, but what Obama should have done with health care, what Bush should have done in Iraq. It's kind of amazing, really. Unlike our unpsychic know-it-all friends, the Internet has grown a hair trigger for premature second-guessing on a grand scale. We indulge in what we should have done before we've even done anything. I suppose, in a sense, this is what punditry is all about. Have strong opinions on Syria and Ukraine, more drones, more sanctions. Be more like Teddy Roosevelt. Be more like Reagan. But don't really do anything. After all, things will turn out more or less the same no matter what we do. Like the Sunni-Shia kerfuffle in Iraq. We should go back in there and contain that and then leave again just to watch it happen again. Being condemned to repeat the past can be fun. The most extreme form of second-guessing is to go back in time for what little kids call a do-over. Had I but done, we say, and then imagine a world in which a done thing has come undone and our lives are immeasurably improved. These time machine remodels include everything from not getting married to telling the boss to shove it to killing Hitler. The problem is, as we all know, you can't really go back in time. That's like unboiling water, undigesting food, and even if we could do it, there are all kinds of unintended and unknown consequences. We save the dinosaurs, but kill a butterfly, and we come back to our own time. We're forced to do data entry for a giant T-Rex-run corporation in a large windowless skyscraper with no health care and nothing to drink come quitting time, if there even is a quitting time anymore, but watery, overpriced beer. Kind of like now, I guess, only with carnivorous dinosaurs running startups instead of gluten-free entrepreneurs. If that's what you want, well, don't come running to me. I told you this would happen. You ever listen to me? No. I gotta go.
Thank you.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Erica Sokolauer-Shane, Orr Gazelle, Dan Brandon, and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is Director of Research. The Marketing Director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio for San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Hey, you made it to the end of the show. Not everybody does.
That means you must really like us. So help us. How can you help us?
Go to philosophytalk.org, look for the I Will Help button, click it, and get ready to help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you so much for donating.